the January 31st, 2020 committee meetings are called to order. The Academic Affairs Committee is the first one. All right. Academic Affairs Committee has several items to bring forth this morning, and I think Madam Provost is here to explain a couple of certificate programs that have been proposed.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Try it again.
Good morning.
Grumble.
Okay, I have two programs for approval this morning, and I'm going to ask Ka Hung, director of the Chinese Flagship Program, to talk about the first. It's an undergraduate certificate in Chinese studies.
The Chinese certificate is 21 hours, so four of the courses are 12 credit hours in the Chinese language. The other three electives are in taught in English related to the culture or practices or traditions of China. So in the spring semester, we have a total of 210 or 220 students taking Chinese courses or Chinese language courses. We have about 80 Chinese majors. So we really want to recruit the rest of the students who are taking Chinese to finish a certificate to help them mark themselves in the job market.
Anyone have any questions?
Do you have any idea how many students might be interested in this certificate?
Our goal is to recruit 10 to 15 students for the first year for 2020 to do the certificate. Hopefully we will grow that.
Okay, very good. Seems an appropriate time to just ask the question, how many of our students are in China right now?
Yes. We have three students in China, and then they are flagship students doing internship. So they are they are returning to the States on Tuesday, February the 4th.
Okay. All right. Do I hear a motion to approve?
So moved.
And a second?
Second.
Motion and a second to approve the undergraduate certificate in Chinese studies as presented. Further discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like so. Motion passes. And then we have...
We also have from the same Department of Modern Languages the approval of undergraduate certificate in German studies. And I believe Dr. Laura McGee, who's the department head of Modern Languages, is going to talk about that certificate. We would like WKU to be able to produce graduates here in the region who have a basic understanding of German language and a good understanding of German culture. We want this region to continue to be a place that is attractive for German investment. We've already benefited from that with the investment of Bilstein Cold Rolled Steel at the Transpark and Fritz-Wintock in Franklin, and my consulting work for these two companies has indicated that cultural training and intercultural understanding is essential for the success of these companies as German management hires Kentuckians and wants to have a sustained plan for stimulating our economy in this region. So we want WKU graduates to be part of that.
Thank you for that presentation. Any comments or questions?
Klaus? As a German, of course, I do believe. Speaking the German language is somewhat voluble. But I'm glad to see the German department, the bachelor got canceled and that there is a new foothold of German programs in the university. So I like that.
Certainly these two languages and populations of people are very appropriate for us to have great interest in. Any other comments, questions? If not, I'll entertain a motion.
So moved.
Motion.
Second.
And a second. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, like sign. Motion passes. Last item we have is an emeritus appointment, and Cheryl, I'll ask you to tell us about that.
Nominated for emeritus status is Dr. Donna Blackburn, professor of nursing. After receiving her undergraduate degrees in nursing from WKU, Professor Donna Blackburn earned her master's and doctoral degrees from Vanderbilt University. She joined the School of Nursing in 1986 and served as department head from 1999 to 2007 and then retired in May 2019. Dr. Blackburn received many academic honors and awards, including the WKU University Award for Public Service, and continues to serve on corporate boards and as a research consultant for healthcare systems.
I can make a comment about Dr. Blackburn. One of my colleagues that I work with every day trained under her and has nothing but glowing remarks. I think she's had a positive impact on many people in the healthcare industry. So. Anyone have any other comments or questions? Not all. Entertain a motion for approval of emeritus status for Dr. Donna Blackburn.
So moved. Second.
Motion and a second. Any further discussion? Not. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed, like sign. Okay. That concludes the items on our list. I would like to indulge everyone for just a minute to make a couple of personal comments concerning our recently deceased ex-interim president and provost, Barbara Birch. I first became aware and got to know Dr. Birch when my wife served on this board in the 1990s, early 1990s. She actually was interim president when my mother was given an honorary doctorate, and in later years I had the privilege of serving with her on this board and particularly closely on our presidential search committee. Barbara was a lady of great intellect and passion. She gave fully and freely to this university, and she's going to be missed. With that, first up on the executive committee agenda is EX-1 authorization to purchase property at 1560 Wall Street. So,
good morning.
Good morning.
I think I got a better reception. So, Jeff, you're going to pull up the PowerPoint for me. Okay, so as Regent McKinley said, we're seeking approval for the property purchase on Normal Street. So the star will show you where the property is located on campus. It's right across from our library, directly across the street. That's what the property looks like. You're probably wondering why we would want to purchase such a property. Well, So it is adjacent to campus, and it's unoccupied and really in bad shape. So the selling price is $113,000, and we would also cover closing costs. Basically, what we would do is take down the structure and construct a parking lot. There's actually two parking lots, one on each side of it, so this would just take that down and make one parking lot. So we're recommending that you give us approval to purchase this property.
All right. Does anybody have any questions?
I read where what they initially were asking for the property, and this is quite a bit less. Can you assure us that this is the best bargaining price we could get?
I think so. Jennifer, do you?
Yeah, Jennifer,
do you know, this has been this project for us.
We actually have an agreement to purchase pending your approval and it is significantly less than what the original asking price was. It's pretty well in line with what the appraisal value was from the owner for the property.
All
And how much will the demolition cost?
I don't have an answer for that. We didn't get Brian Russell involved in that.
Typically,
in that process.
We're going to look about $6,000 to $7,000 for that property taken down. One of the things about the property, it has been on our master plan for years. It's a strategic piece of property. And so we have been looking and asking for an owner past, and I think it is now held by three or four of his
heirs. It's in the estate.
But it would be a good opportunity for the university and get rid of a real eyesore that it's actually a hazard.
No.
You cannot go inside the building because you'd fall through the floors. So it's strategic in nature, the property.
Yeah, I can think of lots of reasons why it would be a mistake not to buy it. I just want to feel like we're getting the price if we can get it.
Yeah. I think Brad Wheeler was working on this before he left the university. I think initially it was around $360,000 they were asking. So this is significantly less. And Brad, I remember one of the last things he told me before leaving that he thought that this was about as low as we could get it.
It is an eyesore. I drove by there today. I'm on the way here, and it's one of those, I dare you to go in there. If I'd been in college and somebody dared me, I would be right in that doorway, sneaking around that building, checking it out. So I definitely think there's a liability issue, too. So, and every time I drive by that, that's what I think about. It's just the big L, liability. And then it is such an eyesore. When you're developing all that area across and doing all that construction and with the Helm Library, it just is not going to be, definitely it is better for us to buy it and tear it down and put a parking lot there.
Quick question. Will we proceed quickly to demolish it once the university owns it?
Absolutely right.
Regent McKinney, if I may also remind the regents that one of the things that we've shifted toward is really having a focus on acquiring and holding properties that are proximate. And given all the other opportunities around us, this one actually is the most proximate to campus. It does a couple of things longer term. In addition to parking, it creates a parcel that is large enough to do something other than parking with in the future. And it also is directly adjacent to Sorority House, and there may be additional opportunities there in the future. So it's an important piece of land for the university.
Any further questions or discussion? If not, I'll entertain a motion.
I'll make the motion.
I'll second.
All right. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes. Next up on the agenda is EX-2, approval of annual salary recommendation for the president. Susan?
So this salary adjustment, I need to explain more closely because I think there is maybe some confusion around this. So this is a result of an IRS audit of the university's presidential residence. And basically, this is not uncommon. It's basically happening all over the United States that the IRS is coming in and auditing these types of issues. And so their finding, this audit began in May of 2018 and concluded, I believe it was in December. And they identified this as a taxable non-cash benefit to the president. So what we did is some research. Christy Smith, our interim CFO, did some research as to how this has been handled by other universities, and we are handling it pretty much the same way that they all have. So the reason they deemed it non-cash, it says non-taxable, I'm sorry, that's a typo, a non-cash taxable benefit, was it has to fall into these three things. We have to check the box for each of the three things. So the residents must be on campus. It is. It must be a contractual obligation, which it is. The contract that President Cavoni has requires that he lives in the resident. And then it has to be for the convenience of the employer, meaning can the president not do his job? can he live someplace else and still conduct his job? The IRS ruled that the president could perform his duties and live basically any place in Warren County. So that's the one of the three requirements that we did not meet. So they deemed it as taxable. So because of that, his taxes, he would basically take a pay cut of about $22,000 if we did not make this salary adjustment. So what we're doing is we're grossing up his salary by $22,500 in order for his net pay to remain the same that it is today. So it's no increase in net pay. It's only to cover the tax liability with the associated increase in the wages.
Thank you, Susan. Any questions or discussion?
Am I interpreting that the tax liability on $22,500 is $18,400?
It's a circular calculation.
It's a circular calculation.
You gross it up, and then the amount you're paying to cover the tax is then taxable, so you pay tax on that additional amount. So then it's like a circular calculation. Every time you gross it up a little more, there's more tax, then you gross it up a little more.
You're the CPA. that looks like a 75% tax rate.
So Jason told me this morning that he assured me he did the calculation when he saw it, and that this was spot on. So
that's why I don't do my tax.
So in essence, what we have is a situation where the president agreed to an employment contract. In that contract, upon agreement, this was a tax-free benefit. We were audited. This is now a taxable benefit.
Right.
I mean, I'm trying to make this a very quick encapsulated thing. And because we do not meet all three prongs of the three-prong definition by the IRS, if we do not change this, our contract, in essence, we're not fulfilling our end of the contract with the president.
Exactly.
Now, is he going to have to go back prior years to pay this? Are they going to make this is starting this year going forward?
Yes.
Was this passed with the same law that made contributions to the athletic department non? No, I think this is always taxable fringe benefits have always been.
Yeah.
I think that we have always. Our most universities have always said that it's for our convenience. The IRS is now disagreeing so probably wants some court cases.
Right. And as I said, this is happening at more and more universities, that they were able to check the three boxes all along, and now the IRS is disagreeing with that third box.
So just from my perspective, so as a staff member, if I take a class, graduate class, undergraduate class, I'm responsible for my own tax liability on that class, but I'm electing to do that, right?
Exactly.
In this case, we are requiring the president to live in this residence. He cannot elect not to, correct, based
exactly.
on the contract. Okay, so that's the big difference in us as staff and faculty being responsible for our own tax liability and this not being in just
right.
a...
We take classes because we want to take classes, not because there's a contractual obligation.
I understand the logic, and I sympathize with it. If we would be in a situation where the university would be flush with money, I can see, we'll do that. But I just wanted to paint a picture how this looks like for a person who is just an employee at this university. So I want to paint several scenarios in terms of the faculty member. So a faculty member who wants to apply for promotion and tenure is required to give presentations at conferences. And, the university tries to reimburse the faculty member for the expense. But, if I would look at my career the last, 20 years, how much do I get? Well, it's rare that you get 100%. Most of the time you get less. Sometimes, a conference is in April and you will be told, well, the funds have expired. There is no money left. And so you're required to do this and you pay with this for after-tax money. Let me give you another example of similar things. Almost all faculty I know have a home office. Okay, and this home office has been created by after tax dollars. You could say, well, they don't need a home office. But at the same time, the university quite often chooses to not heat or cool the working offices which are provided. And so, you don't have much of a choice. And my last example is the following. For the last, I think, 3 years, at the beginning of the academic year, departments asking the faculty, do you really need to have a phone? You could get rid of this phone, and that would save the department some money. I mean, you can use your cell phone if your students want to contact you. You can use Skype. You can use a Google phone or whatever it is. And so from that perspective, right, faculty is used to essentially have lots of things where they use their own money. And as far as I can, where I'm sitting, you are required to do this. Okay? And they don't have an opportunity to come to the board and say, well, make my net salary whole again. That's just the way it is. And so, but I understand the logic, and I sympathize with a loss in salary, but there is no policy for any other employee to, if RIS changes regulations, you take a hit, well, you just got to live with it. The institution makes no attempt to make you whole again. And so, I believe for most employees at this university, this will not create a lot of sympathy, but actually will look quite bad in terms of that we do this for somebody who is on the top of the food chain, but we don't do the same for almost anybody else.
So I want to be absolutely clear in my comments. I think it looks bad optically. What I'm concerned about is that we're in violation of a contract that the university agreed to if we don't do it. And that's what I'm being told. If that is the case, we are acting outside of... It's not logic. I mean, it would be that we're acting outside of a contractual obligation. So we would be... If we do not do this, we are not fulfilling the contract that gives... We'll say it this way, the employee the power to say that we're in violation of the contract. That's what we're being presented with, correct? This is not a, it's not a justification, it's a requirement.
George, are you listening in as president of a university? Any comments?
The first thing is, I guess, when I was listening to class, all of the things that you mentioned, in my mind, are choices. They can choose to work somewhere else. And I think, as David's mentioned, unless it's stated in their contract with the university, I don't know that we can take things that people perceive they must do or choose to do and put it in the same perspective as a contract. The other thing is, I wish you could say that the president and every faculty member and every staff person is equal, but that's not true. Because if anything happens on the campus, it ultimately will fall back to the president. So I don't know that it would be appropriate for us to look at them or treat them exactly the same given the level of responsibility and accountability we are putting within that position. And then I think the last thing is really the point that David makes, is that the contract is pretty clear. It says we're requiring him to live there. Maybe he could save money even from this if he wanted to choose to live somewhere else, but I don't think we contractually are giving him that option. So I recognize the optics issue, but if we were looking at, an apples-to-apples comparison in terms of his level of responsibility, his level of accountability compared to everyone else, it's not the same. So even from optics, it's pretty tough. I think now there will be perception issues. People have their views of all of this because, as Paul said, he's at the top of the food chain. But I'll tell you, the pressure that he has at the top of the food chain is nothing compared to anyone else at the college or at the university.
Okay.
I'll make a motion that we approve the annual salary recommendation for the president.
I second it.
All right. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? Motion carries. All right. Next up on our agenda is EX-3, approval of philanthropic naming request.
And Jason, because, well, he's going to take it down, but yeah. Never mind. Good morning.
We would like to request approval of a philanthropic naming opportunity for the public radio studio in the academic complex as the Spiller Family Studio in recognition of a lead gift from Cora Jane Spiller. Ms. Cora Jane Spiller of Bowling Green, Kentucky, graduated from College High in 1946 and received a bachelor's degree in English in 1950. Her late husband, Colonel Robert E. Spiller, to whom she was married for 66 years, is also a WKU alumnus, earning degrees in 1949, 1950, and 1984. Colonel Spiller was an adjunct professor in military science and also served as the director of the WKU Ag Exposition Center. They have been and continue to be extremely engaged in the life of Western Kentucky University and have been involved in a multitude of activities for many, many years. Ms. Spiller has 36 years of consecutive giving to WKU, and this has been dispersed amongst many areas across campus. She's a lifetime member of the WKU Alumni Association, the Henry Hardin Cherry Society, Society of 1906, and the WKU Sisterhood. This philanthropic naming request is recommended in recognition of Ms. Spiller's lead gift to the WKU Public Radio Studio. Her philanthropy and service to WKU make this a fitting tribute. The WKU Public Media Department will cover the costs of signage for the room.
You know, I can't say enough about the support of the Spiller family over the years, and it's not just the financial support. Oftentimes, when we would have pledge drives, Colonel Spiller would come and not only volunteer for the phone bank, he would pull out his own personal address book, and the phone was at a lull. He would call his friends and tell them what they were going to give to support public radio and television. And that's the kind of effort and the relationships that we have in terms of loyalty all across this campus. The Spillers are a tremendous example of sustained loyalty, especially with regard to public media and other specific areas that have been listed here. They are... We had one particular instance where we had the president of NPR come to campus a couple of years ago. I was able to coax him here, and he said, I want to sit next to the biggest personality in the room when we were driving back from the airport. And I said, are you sure you really want to do that? And he said, yes. And so we put him right with the Spillers. And they had a wonderful time, and that resulted in an additional gift related to public radio. That wasn't the reason we did it, but Jarl, who ultimately began his career in Kentucky, was very pleased to get that opportunity. I know the Spillers were as well. I can't say enough about their continued sustained support. We have worked on this very carefully to make sure that the entire family has been involved in this process, and I think it's a fitting tribute to the Spiller family.
No further discussion. I'll entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion.
I'll second it.
All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. All right. Now we have a philanthropy update from my family.
Thank you all. I appreciate the opportunity to meet with you all today and bring an update on where we are in our activity over the past few months as we gear up for the launch of the public phase of our capital campaign in just a few short months. Overall, we're tracking to about 75% of the goal that we will announce in April. A surprise until that time, but you know, we're really pleased with the progress that we've made. A few highlights on the slide that we're sharing with you today is first of all the Opportunity Fund. This has just been a tremendous effort and asset to our institution already, and we continue to see that this is resonating a lot with our constituents. As of today, $33,315,555 have been given or pledged to the Opportunity Fund. That's up 5.9% since August 13th. That was the president's convocation when we announced a $27 million had been raised to that point. About 25% of that overall goal has been raised in the last 18 months. So again, tremendous momentum as we move forward and are aggressively pursuing the $50 million goal that was announced at the president's investiture in April of 2018. We also have out there about $5 million in verbal commitments. And when you take a look at that, that's really an uptick in activity and conversations with our donors as we get ready to launch. In April, the public phase of the campaign, the activity is picking up, and we're really excited that we have a lot of work in the pipeline that we're working to close as we move towards that public announcement of the campaign. As you move down the list there, one thing I wanted to point out is the declining alumni participation rates, and this is a national trend across the country. You know, frankly, for us, we've not fallen off as much as some institutions have. But this is a national trend, and it's something that's a big conversation in the industry as to how do we combat declining alumni participation rates. While overall dollars are going up, you're seeing that by fewer and fewer donors that are making those gifts to institutions. And so one of the things that we are implementing is digital engagement officers. Those are going to be launching in the next few weeks for us, and I'm really excited about the opportunity and the breadth of the constituents that we're going to be able to contact through that program. Instead of our officers getting in the car and driving or flying to different locations, they're going to be sitting behind computer screens. They're going to be contacting our alumni and our constituents on their cell phones. And so it's going to be a neat test and an opportunity for us to really transition to the next generation and think about how do our younger alumni engage a cell phone digitally. And so we're really excited to launch that program and are optimistic that's going to help buck that trend of declining participation.
Do we know the factors behind the decline?
Recession, number one. We've never recovered from the recession. Middle class, declining, incomes. And so just more also opportunities to give. More and more nonprofits every year are created, and so it's a lot of competition.
I was a program about a year ago. I think I attended maybe a Saturday morning, maybe others were here, but they were some national people that came in to talk about fundraising, and they gave some insight into that. But they were very upbeat because even though that number's going down, the generation that will be giving in the next 10, 15 years, the baby boomers, are in command of a lot of money, and they are perhaps more philanthropically inclined than, say, the millennials. And I think they did use millennials as an example. Right now, they take a different viewpoint.
One of the other issues, particularly for young graduates, is student debt growth. So if you think about the pressure on young people as they leave, they have wages have been pretty flat. The percentage of students leaving with debt is larger, and so that obligation, which is pressuring acquisition and beginning families, is also pressuring philanthropy. The thing that's important about the trend is that even with a growing gift size, a declining number of individuals engaged long-term is a trend we have to stem. Because, and for this reason, because today's annual fund givers, folks who make very small, regular gifts, $100, $50, $10, those are the future donors who will make $25, $50, $100,000 gifts. And the way you begin that relationship and that pattern of giving is really with that annual fund. So this is something, a move that we're making as an institution that is, it's innovative, and it's essentially saying we can't continue to do annual solicitations the way we've always done them. We have to think differently about the way in which this generation both will be identified and cultivated and engaged, and electronically fundraising is typically a conservative business, meaning that we don't adopt innovations, much like higher education, very quickly. But it's time.
Amanda, I would wonder what comments you'd have. We know since 1990, the income inequality business has gotten bigger and bigger, wider and wider. And since 1990, I read, other than the top 1 or 2% earners, incomes have remained flat. So while the top 1 or 2% has gone up exponentially, so I would think you would want to target a lot of your efforts to that 1 or 2%. Is there any discussion?
We do. With our major gift program, that's where we have the one-on-one solicitation happening in your office, in your home, the more personal contact. Really, this digital engagement opportunity is to take it now down into the next 10, 20, 30% of our base. That same experience, that one-on-one, how do you like to engage with the institution? What are the ways that we can connect you to the institution and take in a very holistic viewpoint to a broader audience? And so we're absolutely targeting, the best out there that we can. And, that's where you're also seeing a lot more mega gifts that are being given to institutions. Again, but by fewer people that are investing.
If I could also comment on the folks who do have that accumulated wealth, it is a rare donor who shows up and their first gift is a major gift. It's just not the way folks decide to engage. And so as much as we have to focus on that 1, 5, 10% who have resources, the reality is you never know who that person might be from the time they graduate to the time where they hit that earning potential. And so what we have to do as an institution is make sure every alumnus is engaged as fully as possible so that we've covered all of our bases. You didn't know Bill Gates was going to be Bill Gates when he was, a freshman at Harvard, but if they hadn't paid attention to him.
Do you have lower level entry points or monthly auto draft giving for people? I think for millennials, I think a lot of people will say, well, I'm already giving WKU my money because I pay my student loan debt. Is that age gap there? And asking somebody for a first-time gift of $250, which is a small gift to the university, is big for a first-time donor, especially when they're young. That might be a major gift. So starting at those, would you do $5 a month and be just connected to us is the way to engage young people. And they give to causes that they feel passionate about and tied to. So you see GoFundMe accounts on Facebook to come and help this family, to do these special things, to help pay this for dogs, vet bills. That's where they're giving, not necessarily a long-term relationship with their university.
We have engaged in crowdfunding platforms, fly fishing trips, projects that are passion projects for departments and programs across campus. We're going to continue to do that, particularly when we move to the Day of Giving in April. You're going to see a big focus on that where, micro projects, challenges, opportunities, kind of a gamification type atmosphere to encourage people to participate and challenge their friends. So, yes, we've done that, and we're going to continue to increase our engagement in those type of activities.
Having been on the Alumni Association for 6 years and being the president of that association, I don't feel like the Alumni Association probably supports the efforts philanthropy as well as it could. And I think there probably needs to be a real good look at that particular organization and what we can improve on and not continue to do the same things over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. As we did it that way 15 years ago or 20 years ago, there's no way of changing it.
We are working on that.
And I will tell you that I don't really feel like I wasted my time, but there was lots of times I get in the car. Like, I look forward to seeing you guys. I just have to tell y'all, I come up here, I'm all excited, buy something new to wear, get all my pins on and everything else, and I will tell you that at some point in time, it was a chore to come up here. And you've got a lot of good alumni that were in the association that now no longer feel engaged, and because there's not been an effort of the Alumni Association to re-engage those people very well. And that is probably a base that you could grab hold of. We've done a very poor job of doing that.
I think something I've said frequently since I've been here is meaningful alumni engagement, and that's about you and how you want to engage with the institution. And so we have to provide a variety of opportunities for people to engage the way that they want to engage. And so that's that we're absolutely talking about that. We actually had a panel of the philanthropy team that came over to the Alumni Association Board of Directors this weekend and talked about the campaign and how the association can engage in the campaign. And so we've made a lot of progress to again, it's philanthropy and alumni engagement. It's not just philanthropy, it's not just alumni engagement. And so how can we build those bridges and take a holistic approach to that entire engagement with the institution?
Well, several times when we were on the board, we would have campaigns and contests who could get the most members signed up. And I just will tell you that I won two years, to get the most members to join. But there, if you looked at the group, there were only a few of us that were doing that. And when you only have three or four people and a group of 30, then that's disappointing as well. So you have to have everyone engaged in that group. And I got a really neat cup or a tourist cup type thing to give it as an award. It was actually quite neat. But part of that was because I wanted people engaged and I wanted people to feel about this university like I do. And I know that sometimes enthusiasm is contagious, but there wasn't really that much of that going on in that association. So if we could improve that, that would be great.
Beyond philanthropy, one of the things that we've really pressed upon, given the challenges around recruitment, enrollment, and graduation that we're addressing head on, how can alumni help facilitate recruitment of students? How can they help facilitate job placement after graduation? So, there are many ways that I think folks can give. They can give a little bit of their personal resources, but more importantly, they can give of their time. And we have to make sure that we're actually creating opportunities for that deep engagement, not just surface things. And I love homecoming. I think it's a wonderful celebration. And it's an important part of who we are as an institution. But the reality is that for people to be engaged and excited, they have to do something that has meaning for them. Read your bell, meaningful relationships, meaningful work, those two things. And it can be volunteer work, too.
Can you elaborate a little bit what digital methods you think you can use to engage people?
Zoom? Cell phone? FaceTime?
What do you mean you say cell phone? What do you mean?
FaceTiming somebody or texting with our constituent. Of course, if they give us permission. But you know, Skype, Zoom, any of those sort of video conferencing type activities, like George today, setting up a meeting with someone digitally instead of always having to travel or be there and book out a schedule and being able to really ramp up our efforts to contact more people.
And you think people are going to give you time to do that?
I think so.
It's interesting. The old model used to be, and this is what I grew up being as a young alumni officer and then development officer 30 years ago, is you would have an alumni event in a city. You'd fill out anchor appointments and then other visits you did all day. And the reality is it's almost impossible to get those visits now because people don't want to talk to you in person. It's a really tough thing, particularly those first visits. But this generation, millennials, Generation Z, are actually more comfortable with saying, look, don't come to my office and drop off a folder, but I'll Skype with you or we can have an exchange that way. And so the other thing I think this will allow us to do is leverage information in a way that we've not leveraged it before. So if you think about how it is you do prospecting and identify individuals who may have capacity, doing it electronically is, and using some of the tools available to us through LinkedIn and other things that we have not been leveraging, we think we're going to get some more results that way too.
What I'm worried about is, like, if I look at students or my kids, if whatever this thing vibrates, and they look at it and they don't know who that is,
okay, right,
it's ignored, okay, and so that's what I'm wondering, how you're going to cross that barrier.
We're already dealing with that.
Okay.
When we call and they ignore your emails. So we're hoping taking a different approach to it, that people are going to be more willing to spend 15 minutes from the comforts of their home or their office and talk with us. We're also targeting at the beginning mostly it's going to be people who have already given to us, people who are lapsed. And so they have participated.
Okay.
It's on reactivation and re-engagement of those folks is where we'll start. It's working. Other institutions have done this. It's still very early. We were the third to take with Evertree, the company that we're working with on this platform. We were the third university to sign on with them for this. And so other institutions have done it in-house that have a lot more resources, a lot more staff. We're excited about doing something different and taking a chance on something that I think could have big returns for us in the long run.
How many reiterate what Dr. Cavoni said about travel? I travel a lot. I am on a plane regularly. It's getting more expensive. I mean, we're not talking about just a flight. We're talking about the hotel rooms. We're talking about the rental cars. By the time you start adding that up, and if you're going to get business or trying to get a gift, what you may get out of the expense of the plane ticket, the overnight stay, the rental car, may not be as effective as trying to do it via telephone or Skype, because it is just getting more and more expensive to travel. Rental cars are outrageous, and I've been shocked in the last little bit, even what's jumped from a year, how expensive it is to travel anymore.
I commend your work here. I think that you've done a great job and excited for an announcement and all those things. How many digital engagement officers have you hired?
We're going to have three, and it's actually staff that we already have that we're transitioning to those roles. When I got here, I felt like those three individuals didn't have a whole lot of direction. You know, they were just hopping in the car and maybe driving up to Louisville, spending a day, seeing folks, which is great, but there wasn't a whole lot of strategy to what they were doing. And so this presented an opportunity for us to transition them into those roles. Actually gave them the option, sat down with them and said, this is something new we want to try. Let them sit in on the presentation, and they're all very excited and can't wait to get started. So,
if they develop a relationship digitally with somebody, will they keep that relationship and then go visit, or does that then pass off to someone else?
It will be digital until they, you know, that person rises to the level of a major gift opportunity. Then the in-home, in-person visit will start taking place. But a lot of it's going to be almost like the phone-a-thon, too. It's kind of the next level of the phone-a-thon system, where it's very targeted. It's almost a reminder of, you know, you made a nice gift. You made a $1,500 gift to us last year. Don't forget about us. You know, what other ways can I help you engage with the institution? And I think, again, shifting to engagement rather than just that transactional asking for money is important as we look at the next generation of engagement with our institution.
Amanda, the other statistic I remember from that presentation was that we do operate a pretty lean organization.
Very lean.
And since you're new to it, you feel like you're getting what you need at this point.
Never. but we're doing, you know, coming up with ways like this that I think we can maximize our investment is challenging. We've cut phone-a-thon, we've cut mail, we've cut staff, as everybody has. But it takes money to raise money, and so it's tough. We've spent the last year really fine-tooth comb through the budget, really making sure that we're putting our investment into the right places. And so I think we're maximizing every dollar that we have in our budget.
Hey, Phil, can you hear me?
Yes.
I just want to make a couple of comments. First of all, I endorse and support everything Amanda and Cavoni have said. We actually, at the college, offer a chartered advisory philanthropy. So we work with folks that are in the philanthropy space across the country. And everything that they have shown is the challenges that we see and hear from folks in this space that are trying to raise money. Some additional things that I would add to the comments they've made. One is about this next generation. We're anticipating some $60 trillion, that's with a T, wealth transfer over the next 20 to 29 years. That is money that's going to be transferred to women, and money that's going to be transferred to the next generation of folks that have a different perspective than most of us sitting in the room and involved in this process. And where we're saying that the next gen has a different philosophy, their investment approach and where they want to give has really been more on social justice and equality and things, you know, climate change, things of that nature. And so colleges and universities and others are going to have to rethink what we're asking for, how we're going to apply and use dollars, how we can tell our story that somehow or another can relate to this new generation of thinking around where we give our money. The other thing that we're seeing, which is very interesting, is that people are being asked by so many sources for contributions that there's this huge growth in donor advised funds. That is, you just put your money into a pot, and then there's a, you know, Fidelity has a large one, that's actually the largest in the country. Vanguard has one, but people give their money, they get a tax write-off immediately. They've got a structure where someone is, they can tell them, here's what I'm interested in, and then that donor advised fund will go out and do all the work for them. And then that actually may take away that personal relationship we have with them as it relates to them being an alumni. The other thing that we've seen is that everybody is trying to keep money locally. And so if I'm in Philadelphia, and I'm an alumni of Western Kentucky University, and I'm building relationships and networking in Philadelphia, they're really pressing me to be more engaged in the community there so that they can define their community as a charitable place to live. And so these are all additional pressures on top of what has already been shared that we're going to be facing. Yet, when I look at these numbers, it's pretty impressive what we've been able to accomplish up to this point. And even so with the declining participation, I think it's a very, very positive story, but it is tough. And Amanda said the most important thing that sometimes I think people forget, it takes money to raise money. And if you don't have the infrastructure and support, if you don't have this digital approach to how you're going to go after the next generation, then you're just going to get farther and farther behind. Because eventually, all of us who still want to give money the old way and still like to get our mail and all those other things, we're going to fade away. And if the university, its challenge is she has pressure today to raise money, but is even more to put the infrastructure in place to ensure we're raising money in the future.
So, I agree. Just very quickly, I agree 100% with what George has said. When we look at a very loyal audience, for example, public media is known for a very loyal audience. And 5 years ago, we began targeting differently because we specifically saw a reduction in transactional giving. Now, we have switched from under 30% of sustaining members. So what we call a sustaining member is a monthly giver that may give at a specific amount. That now is up to over 60% of our base. So we have approximately 900 monthly contributions that come in specifically related to our cause. So we very much agree with this approach and have seen it work with a very loyal base. Now, the reason that's been effective for us is we have that one-to-many communication platform. We can go on the radio or go on television every day or go on our digital platforms and communicate directly. So I applaud this effort. I think it echoes a national trend, one that had happened just a few years ago in public media. Now, the reason that matters is it has happened with an older audience. So I think it will matriculate through all age groups, and I think the university will benefit ultimately from it.
Two quick reminders before I leave. Campaign kickoff, April 17th, Friday evening. Be a lot of fun, very inclusive. I think it's going to be a very different event than we've been having here at the institution in the past when we kick off a campaign or have a president's gala. So we're really excited about that. Hope that you all will be there. Very involved with student-centered celebration. Again, opportunity fund and a lot of the work that we're doing there. And then our first ever dedicated day of giving will follow on that Tuesday, April 21st. So again, a lot of the things that we're talking about and ways that we can engage this audience, well, that's how we can take the campaign kickoff to a broader audience, to the $50, the $25, the $5 giver on those days. And so a lot of work to do in the next few months, but we're really excited and think that we've made a lot of progress to this point, and we'll be excited to
All right, next up is on our information items for the legislative update.
Morning.
Good morning.
It's Jennifer.
Okay, well, legislative session is underway. So it's not been too crazy up there just yet. It's still pretty quiet, and I think that's all about to change now that the governor has introduce his budget. Wanted to just give you a quick update. I'm sure you all are all aware of this, but the budget recommendation for post-secondary education, what CPE submitted to the governor was to increase the performance funding pool in the first year of an additional 6.2%, which was about $52 million. In the second year, an additional 2.6%, which would be a total of 8.8 over the biennium, and that total would be about $75 million. In the governor's budget, he zeroed out performance funding. So instead, he gave all the universities a 1% increase in our base appropriation, but he did take out all funding from for performance funding. I doubt that that stays that way, seeing as we have a statute that requires performance funding, and I think that the House and the Senate are very invested in performance funding. President and I had several meetings on Wednesday with some key legislators, and so I fully expect to see performance funding be put back into the House budget here in the next month or so. The other thing that we asked for in the budget request was for asset preservation. This is to take care of some, and Brian can probably talk a little bit more to this, but to take care of infrastructure needs. These are not exciting things. This is like our underground steam line, correct?
Yep.
And go ahead.
Yeah, we've had I think the Commonwealth of Kentucky, the last report that I saw, as a university with 6 million, we've got about $530 million worth of deferred maintenance per the state has identified. Does that mean we're not operational? No, we're very operational, and that's what we try to maintain. So it is a real it's promising.
So the $400 million that higher education requested, that's not just $400 million with WKU, that was a matching pool. So it would be for every dollar the state, or for every $2 the state put in, we put in a dollar. The governor did include money. He calls it his resurgence fund instead of asset preservation, but he put it in at $200 million, so half of what was requested. Hopefully that will stay in as well. And we certainly, when we met with the speaker, we met with the House Chairman of Appropriations and Revenue on Wednesday, and explained how important that is, our needs. And we said, you won't really see where we spend all that money, but because, like I said, it's project, it's not buildings. It's things to keep the campus moving forward. So. This is obviously the very first step in a very long budget process. I don't expect to see anything come out of the House until March. The President will testify on February 13th in front of the Budget Review Subcommittee on Post-Secondary Education. All of the universities, they split us up over 3 weeks, give us an opportunity to explain what we need as far as the budget goes. So he will do that on the 13th. Beyond that, I'm going to force him to come spend a lot of time with me in Frankfurt, meeting with lots of legislators and sharing our story and talking about the great things we have going on campus, but also our needs. And the message we did receive on Wednesday was, we know higher ed can't take much more. So I'm hoping that will follow through.
Thank you, Jennifer, and I'll just add the message that we're sharing, not just from WKU, but across all of our institutions, is that what has happened for the past decade cannot happen, and that the best way for us to continue to grow as a state and economy is an investment in higher education. That's a legislative-oriented message. For us to do what we need to do, we need the state to be good partners, and that means they have to do their share. $500 million here in deferred maintenance on state assets. One of the things, and I know this will come up later, is taking care of our infrastructure is a desperate need on this campus. We are being as proactive as possible, but the reality is we also
are at a place where we're reacting to unplanned immediate needs from infrastructure. And so $500 million here, it's $7 billion across the higher education system. And so people don't want to study, obviously, in crumbling infrastructure. I think it's a real opportunity for us. Performance funding, I've always articulated it this way and will continue during the session to talk about it. I think it is appropriate for the taxpayers of the state, for the legislature, to ask for us to be held accountable for what it is they're investing in. And so I do think, given the conversations I've heard, that the way in which that funding growth is allocated is likely to change and probably move back toward performance funding. The last thing that the governor put in his budget, it started another conversation. You will recall last year there was a great deal of work on pension around KERS. The governor has shifted some resources around. They've worked to think about the level of contribution required from universities and quasis to that pension fund. And as much as I did not want to talk about pension, I wanted to talk about graduation and recruitment and affordability for students. Pension is likely to be part of the conversation again this year. And we will talk about that as you as regents, we as a campus, as we think about KERS, the contribution that would be required for us to meet our obligation to that system if there were some soft exit, and what that looks like over the long term and how doable is it. You may have seen an article in the Courier Journal just a couple days ago where the interim president from Eastern Kentucky said, you know, we're stuck between a hard place. We can't afford to exit. We can't afford to stay in. What are we supposed to do? And I think we, as a university, as challenging as it may appear, and it is challenging, obviously, financially, where higher education is, we're in a much better position both because of scale and the proactive work we've done than our sister institutions. So know that will be coming up as well. I'm positive about the session. The tone in Frankfurt compared to my first 2 years in Frankfurt has been a breath of fresh air. I do think there is a spirit of collaboration and cooperation that did not exist, and the tone is just different. I'm not certain that it changes any of the outcomes, but it's a more pleasant place to be, at least so far.
Is CPE's position on the performance funding similar to yours?
So the presidents all agreed that we were asking for that 6.2, then up to 8.8% to go through performance funding, and so we've all signed on to that. That will continue to be the request. I'm appreciative of the work that the governor has done. Part of this has to do with a conversation around what's the effect of the performance funding model on institutions. And it has the effect of shifting from one institution to another dollars. And part of that is appropriate, given the number of students based upon appropriation funding that some universities have versus what we might have as a larger place that has grown over time. There will be, by statute, a performance funding work group that I'll be on that begins sometime in the spring, summer, to re-examine performance funding. What are the effects of performance funding and what are potentially the unintended consequences of the model that was assembled? One of the critiques that I made last year during testimony around performance funding was that it is built as a 100% growth model. You're rewarded for only getting bigger, having more. There's no efficiency measures included. That makes little sense in the environment where we have a declining age cohort going to college. That's one issue. The second issue is, if you recall last year, there was a reduction in funding that went through the performance model. Performance funding only works when it is an incentive, meaning there's additional money for which you're competing, not trying to avoid a reduction. It just doesn't work. And so there'll be lots of conversations in the next few months. It's a good start, but 3 long months to go between here and there.
Any further discussion?
You mentioned the retirement system. In the Courier Journal, it said that the government proposed that he wants to lower these rates, freeze them, but that you still anticipate that we will face the question whether we're going to get out of the system or not.
We will, and reduce the rates for 2 years. So this is not—it's not in perpetuity. There's no permanent freeze, and the number that was floated is 67%. But so we got some more information about that just
it's
yesterday.
It's supposed to go up to 93%, is what KERS has requested. The budget is a 93% floating contribution rate. Governor, that at 67. It's kind of hard to see this in there, but apparently, from what budget staff has told us yesterday, is that the governor then gave the comprehensive universities some additional funding to cover the difference between 49 that we're paying now and that 67, so that we would stay at 49%. But you know, the message we received on Wednesday was, okay, but we're already making this worse by the universities being held at 49%, and we understand that. But so they're saying, so now for 2 more years, we're going to do that again, and it's just going to keep kind of digging that hole. So not sure what they're going to do about that.
So as you think about what the size or the magnitude of our obligation might be in that one system, depending upon the choice we would take, it could be as much as $150 million. That would absorb not just all of our bonding capacity today, it would absorb all of our bonding capacity for almost ever. We'd never be able to do another project that required bonding. So I think that's probably unlikely to be an option. There is an escalator, a 1.5% escalator that would be put in place that would go up every year. It would be our contribution annually to whatever that obligation is. I argue at least you know it's 1.5% every year, but I don't know what that starting number is yet. And if that starting number is higher than we could manage as an institution, is that even an option? So we'll have these. If you remember the timeline, we'll begin these conversations this semester. We have to notify between and. The regents will have to vote between April 1st and May 1st to make some sort of decision. And so we are statutorily only now beginning to get the information from the pension folks. So it will be a conversation.
Isn't it due today?
This is the earliest they can give it to us.
Oh. Yeah. Nothing like making a $150 million decision under highly constrained time.
Okay. Anything further? Thank you. That concludes our agenda for the executive committee. Now, on to the